Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another in our Journey series, interviews with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers. Today we continue our conversation with Paul Ellie. The book he has written is The Life You Save May Be Your Own, an American pilgrimage intertwining the lives and work and journey of Flannery O'Connor, Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, and Walker Percy. We're standing back and asking, if you were a young writer today and you were going to read these four, you're serious about your faith, what are you going to learn from their example? And Paul has started out by talking about who they were as readers and the way they read, and we're talking about how they become writers. And we were, when we broke, talking about the radical nature of the enterprise of serious writing and serious reading, that it is an undertaking that has severe consequences. And you know, just to step back, Paul, you're in the publishing business, and you know that such books are these days are rare, and they tend to be read by serious readers, of whom there seem to be fewer. These people, though, did not worry about whether they were reaching masses or not. It seems to me that one of the things they had in common was that they were writing to work out their own journey, and if others connected, they certainly, in the case of Merton, he early on especially had this deep desire to be widely read. But ultimately, their writing enterprise was more about their own pilgrimage than about publishing and getting the next deal. Is that accurate?
I think that is accurate. All of them felt it vitally important to communicate.
Yes.
None was for art for art's sake. Walker Percy saw writing, for example, as a message in the bottle, you know, put in by one person to be urgently sent forth and read by another. That said, they situated themselves to some degree at the margins, and I think their Christian faith had to do with that. They didn't expect to be at the center of things.
Yes.
Since they shunned the limelight, one's in a monastery, one's in a non-place, as he called it, Covington, Louisiana.
Yes.
One's in rural Georgia. And Dorothy Day, who was really in the thick of things as a advocate of social justice, was at some distance from the literary world.
Yeah.
So they wrote for a community of admirers, let's say, confident that it would find its way into the general culture.
When we talk about their community of admirers that would find its way into the general culture, how would you describe their sense of calling as a writer?
Well, I think that each had a very specific sense of calling. Merton, well, let me backtrack a bit. What strikes me looking at their sense of calling is how willing they were to follow a distinctive way and follow it at some distance and not try to be all things to all people, mm-hmm. let's say.
Yes.
When Walker Percy decided to take up fiction and philosophy, this was something that wasn't done in his illustrious Southern family.
Yes.
It's often forgotten now that he spent nearly 15 years from the end of World War II until the publication of The Moviegoer,
yeah.
Writing essays that were read by a few dozen philosophers at most,
yeah.
Working out his ideas. Yes, he had a small independent income, but beyond that, he had a lot of courage to follow his calling and not be dissuaded, even
yeah.
if it took some years to get where he was going.
Yeah. Well, you talk about the issue of seekers of the real. This is something that they all had in common.
That's right. I think both great writing and religious faith for them represented something fundamentally real. There are aspects of each for them that represented a kind of flight away from everyday life, but when you get down to it, they saw a great book as bringing a kind of news that had a reality that the papers and newsreels often did not.
Yeah.
Likewise, their religion, they thought that it told the truth about things in a way that, let's say, contemporary philosophy often did not.
When you think about the point that you were making just a minute ago about the fact that they, in a sense, each of them wrote from the margins, how was it that they found champions in the publishing world? How was it that they didn't seem to play the game and be in the right place, they nevertheless got the attention of people in publishing.
Well, I think that luck had a lot to do with it. Thomas Merton was a college classmate of Robert Giroux's.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't been Giroux's classmate, The Seven Story Mountain might never have been published, and
yeah.
he might never have become the most famous monk in the Western world. At the same time, they knew that it was necessary for them to get their work out there, and they set about finding people they trusted in the so-called general culture and working closely with them. Instead of demonizing mass society, they figured that there were reasonable people inside it who would understand their work, and they went forth with confidence. Flannery O'Connor, for example, met Robert Giroux in New York. She was introduced by Robert Lowell, a person she trusted, to Giroux, who is his editor. Giroux gave her a copy of The Seven Story Mountain. And the way I tell it in my book, that said to her, here's an editor who will understand the religious preoccupations at the center of my novel, which was Wise Blood.
Interesting.
And she felt understood in advance because he gave her this book about another man with religious preoccupations.
Yeah. What's so fascinating about this, and again, you being in the business, is that here these writers ultimately connected not only widely to a broader culture in their own day, but they tapped into something so deeply human and something that so many people connected with that they still have shelf life today. I mean, you can still pick up all of these authors in most bookstores. And yet, think about it, at the time, they had to have a champion in a publishing house to get published. So it says that there is a pent-up kind of longing for people that write from an individual standpoint, that have a perspective and a point of view, but if they don't get a champion within the kind of the inner circle, they may never reach that audience that is, well, demonstrably there.
I think that's true, and to some degree, I'm sure that the publishing culture seems hostile to ideas like the ideas they have in their books. At the same time, they knew that the best way to get their word out was to write extraordinarily well.
Yeah.
Flannery O'Connor was asked once whether the fact that she was a Catholic meant that she was less than an artist. In other words, that she thought the truth was self-evident or was to be found in the catechism or some such, and so she didn't really have to bother with the art. And she said, on the contrary, because people were suspicious of her background and her convictions, she had to be all the more of an artist. And I think that's true of all four of them. They really outdid themselves in their effort to make work that was of the highest quality.
Yeah.
And also, they just didn't assume the suspicions of a culture. They sought to meet the supposedly uninterested reader halfway and woo them into the work.
But when you talk about the craft, I mean, it's interesting because all of them were kind of, they were not in the typical writer's colony kind of places. I mean, they were in places where the craft was very much hammered out in isolation.
It's true. They all had very important mentors at certain points. To some degree, the kind of mentoring process that they enjoyed in an ad hoc way has been institutionalized. So they have more in common with writing program students than might initially seem to be the case.
Interesting.
Merton got it as an undergraduate, for example.
Yeah.
O'Connor and Percy both sent their novel to a celebrated writing teacher named Carolyn Gordon in the same week.
Join us for our next podcast with Paul Elliott. Thank you for listening to Journeys on the Kindling's Muse.